welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to It's Inside Job. I am really glad you could join me for a new week and a new episode. This week, I have another interview lined up for you guys. I'm very privileged to be joined by Dr. Rui Gamavaz, who is a retiree from the WHO, the World Health Organization. Now, he worked for 22 years for the organization in different capacities, a medical doctor from Mozambique with an MPH from the University of Washington. Prior to his retirement from the WHO, he was the coordinator of Country Cooperation Unit in headquarters in Geneva. In Dr. Vaz's long and distinguished career, he's held many key positions in the WHO. I'll just mention a couple of them. The rest you can find in his bio. He was also the head of the WHO country office in Nigeria and the program area coordinator for polio in the WHO regional office for Africa. Another key role he had was as the WHO representative in Angola, where he acted as the regional advisor for HIV/AIDS. Also, one of his key successes was when he supported the national authorities in Nigeria in containing the Ebola epidemic in 2014 and the interruption of polio. He's also supported the government of Angola in interrupting twice the polio transmission and several other emergencies during the Civil War. When I first met Dr. Rui Vaz, it was when I was invited by the United Nations System Staff College to participate on a panel on pandemic response and leadership. And the topics we explored on the panel were field lessons, leadership styles, and self-management. And just as an interesting side note, my good friend and colleague Agnes Jaharty shared the panel with Dr. Vaz and myself. You can find actually her interview and episode in Season 1, Episode 9. But anyways, back to Dr. Vaz. I found his story, his experience, and the knowledge he shared during that panel very engaging, very fascinating. And this is well before I started this podcast. For me, this was a great conversation. I learned so much. And I hope you, dear listener, will draw as much information and inspiration as I did. So let's slip into the stream and meet Dr. Rui Vaz. Well, I'd like to welcome Rui Vaz to It's an Inside Job. Welcome. Good morning, Rui.
Morning, Jason.
I've wanted to talk to you for a while. I think the first time we met was on a WHO panel. I think it was about a year ago, talking about pandemic response or something of that nature. Was that correct?
Correct.
If we could begin the conversation by maybe you introducing yourself and what you do.
Good. Once again, thank you, Jason, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this interview. It's indeed is a privilege and honor. So my name is Rui Vaz. I am a medical doctor from Mozambique, and I also have a master's in public health from the University of Washington in Seattle in the U.S. I just retired almost 4 years ago from WHO. Where I worked for 22 years in the organization in different capacities. Before my retirement from WHO, I was coordinating the country cooperation unit in our headquarters in Geneva. But before that, I was WHO country representative in Nigeria, which I can speak a little bit later on what it happens, also in Angola and in Seychelles. I also had the privilege to coordinate the polio program in our regional office in Brazzaville. And I was also regional advisor for HIV and AIDS, also for the African region. It means that I was coordinating the activities of our 47 WHO country office in the African region. But before joining WHO, which was now 26 years ago, I was the director of the National Institute for Health, which is the national research institution in Mozambique. Prior to that, I was the provincial medical director for one province in the north of Mozambique with 3 million inhabitants. And when I finished my medical course around that time in 1981, mm-hmm. I was a district medical officer. I was a unique physician in that district with around 70,000 inhabitants. So briefly, this has been what I have done since I finished my medical training around 42 years ago.
It's definitely a fulfilling career. And all the things that you've done. And the reason I wanted you on the show, Ruiz, I think, you know, you have a very unique perspective of how to look at resilience, whether it's building individual resilience or team resilience, because you've been in some very complex situations. Just, you know, previously talking to you and then obviously going through your CV, your resume. I mean, you've led teams in some really intense areas of the world through your career. And because this podcast focuses on building resilience, that's kind of where I want to take the conversation, because I think you have a really interesting perspective to add to this conversation on resilience. I was wondering, could you tell us a little about, you know, your time in, whether it's Nigeria or what have you? Maybe we could start with Nigeria, where you had the Ebola initiatives to sort of tackle that challenge. What was that like for yourself?
Let me explain. When I went to Nigeria, this was in 2012, I was as the head of WHO country office. But at that time, we didn't have Ebola. The main reason why I was being requested to go to Nigeria at that time, it was to support the country to end the transmission of polio.
Polio, yes.
Nigeria at that time was the unique country in the African region where polio was also still endemic. But let me give you the context. Nigeria is a federation with 170 million inhabitants with 37 states at that time in 2012. And it was facing a tremendous challenge in terms of emergencies due to Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, particularly in the northern part of the region. So then we have around 15 million people, IDPs, internal displaced populations, moving from one side to another side. So at concomitant, we also had several other outbreaks, like cholera, meningitis, all of these. So it was a tremendous challenge for everybody, but particularly for WHO, we have been requested to support the government. And that is the main point. So we were there to support the government to fix the problems, not to be part of the problems. And one of the things that was the major challenge for me, I was coordinating the country office with 2,700 personnel. So we had around 500 staff, and the remaining numbers were main surge capacity. It's people that was under with WHO contract, but mainly recruited locally. So it was a challenge for me addressing and lead a country team so vast with 37 sub-office, with tremendous number of people, with pressure from everybody. So this put me in a very clear situation. Mm-hmm. The first one is to define what should be our priorities. Because when you go for a country like Nigeria and many other countries, particularly in the African region, mm-hmm. you have simultaneously several challenges. And you need to define what is your priority. The second one is when you have a large team, you need to be very clear in terms, you and the entire team, we need to be very clear what are the rules of the game. So what do we expect from each of you? What are the deliverables? And how I'm going to put all of you, including myself, accountable? At the end, I was the one that was accountable for the government. I didn't care if they had 10,000 people working with WHO. What the government and partners were looking for is for results. Are you guys helping us to interrupt the polio epidemic or not? So, and this was a challenge for me. And one of the things that I did myself, with the involvement of the entire team, is to create an accountability framework. This was with key performance indicators. But one of the issues that what I did is to delegate authority with 37 sub-offices. We had zonal coordinators, we had state coordinators. That was important to everybody to feel part of the game. It's not myself. I was like in an army, I was a general. But you had to also have the soldiers. You have the people on the ground that could help you. So that was a tremendous challenge. And this was published in the International Journal of Infectious Disease. Our experience addressing improving performance of our team and the program using the accountability. So then in 2014, we had the Ebola outbreak. It was another challenge because with 170 million inhabitants, everybody was real scared. That is going to be the end of the world with Ebola around there. And the virus affected the city of Lagos. Lagos is a city with 30 million inhabitants during the day. At night, it reduced to around 15 million because it's a commercial city. So this was a challenge, people coming in and going out. So the risk of transmission was very, very high. But at the end, we, WHO, the government, and different partners, we were able in 93 days to interrupt the transmission. And I was pleased and proud that on behalf of the WHO Director General, Dr. Margaret Chan, I declared Nigeria Ebola-free at that time, 93 days after the index case was reported.
That's an amazing feat to consider that, you know, Lagos is 30 million people during the day. And obviously, 15 million, half of that population is moving in and out because it's a city of merchants and trading. And that to be able to stop the spread of such a thing within a business quarter, 90 days or a little over 90 days, it's an amazing feat of you and your team. And so just to rewind for a sec, Rui, you said that for yourself, when you're managing such complex teams over a country, I think you said 37 sub-offices and 2,700 people, you said the major thing is to define priorities, to be clear as to the priorities for yourself, your team, and the people under you. The second is to clearly understand the rules of the game, the sort of the rules of engagement. And that comes down to who's accountable for what. And what I understand, does that mean that the roles and responsibilities are well-defined? And through that, you created an accountability framework. Is that what I understand you said?
Correct. So the accountability framework, it was one of the critical measures that we took in order to show with evidence base if you are performed or if you are not performed as expected. So this was delegated based on key performance indicators that we define. Each member of our team with the 2,700 people, they knew exactly what was expected from each of them every month. And on a quarterly basis, the state coordinator issued a technical report showing him in green, yellow, or red if he has accomplished what was expected or not. At the end of the 3 months, he receives that report. And if you are performing in yellow or below expectations in red, you are going to be warned that you need to improve your performance. 6 months after, so it means 6 months since the beginning of the performance, if you are still in yellow or red, your contract will be ended. And this was made very clear to everybody. At the end of first year, Jason, I had the responsibility and I interrupted 211 contracts for poor performance. This was a challenge for me because everybody was saying, Dr. Vaz, you know, be careful. You are in Nigeria. You are in a country A, B, C, and D. So be careful about your own security. But that was a way, if you don't take actions, nobody will trust you. You need to show results. And people need to be clear that they are not giving me a favor. Our favor, it was to interrupt the polio. and save lives. And yes, that was my responsibility at the end. And this is why you are there. So, but with the accountability framework, those that were performing well, they also receive a signed letter by myself every 6 months, congratulating them and pushing them to go and to move ahead and give examples to the others. Those that are performing still in yellow, they receive a warning explaining what were the weaknesses. And we as the country office, we are providing them training to improve in the weakness areas. So it was a way not to, to punish people, but rather than to motivate them to move the agenda. But all of this was done jointly. It was not from my head. We've involved people since the beginning and say, is this okay? Because the states were different. The contexts were different. And this is when you lead a team, you need to understand the different contexts where people were working. Working, for example, in Angola from the, in the north and the center of in the south is different. You need to adjust how you are going to move. And we had multicultural teams, people coming without their own families, working in environments very complex with emergencies. Some people have been kidnapped. Some have been killed because of Boko Haram. How you motivate them to continue working? And this is why my responsibility was also to visit them on the ground, to see you are not alone. You are there. I am also here with you. Let's go in. Let's move. Some of them, they had more than 1 year without speaking with the families, alone. So how you help them? People that they didn't have psychologists around, they didn't have anybody. They were alone to help them to move the agenda. Particularly when you work in countries where the health systems is weak. And sometimes the health system is not functional. But you are there to help them to move the agenda. So this is the context. This is how accountability was key. And this has been, I present it with all 194 member states, WHO country representatives, to explain to them what was added value of accountability. And it was published in the International Journal.
In the first part of our conversation, Rui talks about being in the midst of a complex situation with multiple challenges. And he spoke to some key lessons that he learned as a leader in those complex environments. His first point, he spoke to being clear about your priorities and communicating those priorities, especially when facing multiple challenges head on. The second, well, that was the need to be very clear in your communication as to what are the rules of the game, what are the rules of engagement. And he shared three questions. What are the expectations? What are the deliverables? And how do we hold each other accountable? And that leads to his third point, is creating an accountability framework with key performance indicators, KPIs. As we move into the second part of the conversation, Rui talks about his time and his experience in Nigeria during the Ebola crisis of 2014. And specifically, he talks about how to build resilient teams. And that comes back down to being humble in the sense of distributing authorities, being able to learn from an ongoing situation, to have situational awareness so you can pivot on a moment's notice. But part of that pivoting, that ability to change direction, well, that comes back down to planning, prioritizing, coming up with backup plans with your team. It also means by empowering your team, by drawing from their experiences, drawing from their opinions and their beliefs and their thoughts about a situation. But the common denominator to all those skills is communication, communication, communication. Well, I'll let Rui speak more to this. So one of the major things I understand you're saying, Rui, is that feedback culture was so important. And you used a sort of a stoplight, things of green, yellow, red, and each of those indicators, each of those lights were quite clear and well-defined when it came to the accountability framework. If you and your team were able to get the fundamentals correctly as to feedback and accountability, then it allowed you to adapt and be flexible in such a complex and ever-evolving environment. Is that what I understand?
Correct. Yeah. You need to build your team together. You need to put on the table the strategies. But you need, and this was one of my lessons learned,
yes,
you need to think out of the box. And you need to involve your people. If this doesn't work, let's think about different scenarios. Let's not wait. And when I delegate that authority, when the people working under Boko Haram in the northeast, far away to be there, I gave the responsibility of our state coordinators to take actions, to save lives. Don't wait for me to say, go ahead. Go, take your decision, assume your responsibility. This happens also with me. When we had Ebola, I took decisions that was expected to be taken by regional director. And I said, no, I'm not going to wait 12 hours or 24 hours to receive the go-ahead. I'm here to save lives, to support the government to save lives. I'm here to fix the problems, not to be a bureaucratic person waiting for ABC to decide. I had that responsibility. This is why I think all of us, independent of with whom we are working,
yes,
we need to assume our responsibility. Today, we have the knowledge, we have the skills, we have the technology. There is no excuse for us not doing the things when it is needed. But we need to assume responsibility up to the end. If I failed, I say, I failed, but I tried my best. And this is what I used to tell to my people. You are not expected to succeed every time. But you will certainly be blamed if you didn't take actions in order to save and to fix the problems. So be conscious. This is not rock science. Use the good senses, but take actions to save lives.
And what I hear is that it became clear for you and your organization, you and your people, what the true value was. The priority was to save lives, regardless of whatever it was, danger to that life. That was the main driving force. And what I also hear you, Rui, is that you distributed the power and the responsibility out to the fields. And when I hear other leaders such as yourself at your level of skill and knowledge speak to this, that a lot, when you can distribute that power across the board, because sometimes the communication channels may fail and they need to have situational awareness. And sometimes, you know, the command chain gets broken for whatever. But when you give them accountability, you give them responsibility, and you give them credibility in the sense of they can, and autonomy, they can make decisions. But it's based on one primary thing, and that is to save lives. Is that what I understand you've Correct. Communicated to me, Rui?
Definitely.
I was wondering, you know, in such a complex environment in which you've worked, and if we just keep it to Nigeria from 2012 to 2014 and such, how you said when uncertainty came, when things kind of went sideways on you, you and your team would sit down and play out a number of scenarios. Is that what I understand?
With 37 states, the socioeconomic and security situation was different. The same in Angola, where I was worked. So the people that were working there, they knew much better than me than what was the realities. What was the best strategies to implement? You cannot write in stone. You need to adjust realities. And this is an example that the success in one country, we cannot copy and paste in another country. It is not going to work. For example, people are asking, can you use this, for example, to tackle the epidemic in Afghanistan and Pakistan? No way. The environment is different. People are different. The sociocultural situations are different. You need to look for what are the exactly scenario where you are working for. And one thing that I learned is the unique thing that is predictable in complex emergencies is that things might go different from what you expect. And therefore, you must be prepared. You must think ahead. If this is not going to work, what can we do? But this type of mentality, you need to put in the heads of people that are working on the ground. But again, the critical issue is to empower them. When you are lead, success is all about growing others. So you need to help our people to move the agenda. You need to give, even when they fail, you need to give a hand and say, let's move. That is, you take the lead. It was your good chance to solve the problems. Because sometimes it always seems impossible until it is done. This is what Nelson Mandela used to say.
Yeah.
But if you want to succeed, you should not stop today. Otherwise, you lose the train. So try. And try from your best, from your heart. And then tell me, I tried this, it didn't work. I tried that, and I succeed or I failed. And we are together. And this was the type of discussion that we used to have on a quarterly basis with our zonal and state coordinators. Not put fingers to people, but we put fingers what are the best strategies for us to move as a team, as an organization. And this is why it was very important for me as the head of WHO country office to have regular contacts with my supervisors, the regional director in AFRO and the director general, Dr. Margaret Chan in headquarters. Every time I put them aware, this is what is going on. This is the importance of communication. Communication not only with your supervisors, but also with your supervisors. So those that you are supervising them, and maintain them, everybody on the same page.
There was a number of things there. I mean, just the DNA of your leadership is to take it apart. You know, one of the major things I hear you constantly speak to is the learning culture. People will make mistakes, and it's not to berate them, but it's to learn from them. But it's also to take action, to be decisive, to address those mistakes, to address those mishaps, to create this learning and adaptable culture. And I think that's so key to resilience for teams or organizations, is that if you can learn and adapt to the situation and not just copy, paste, and action onto something. Because as you said, the response you have in Angola or in Nigeria is not going to be the same for Pakistan or Afghanistan. You have to trust the individuals on the ground and listen to them, to what they have to say, because maybe they have the expertise because they are the locals. So that leads me to another question, because you say we don't have a blaming culture, but we have a learning culture, and together we adapt and move forward to deal with whatever the uncertainty or crisis is. I was wondering, you know, when you come in, how do you build trust, or how do you trust people? Like, maybe you've never worked with them before, but you are so reliant on them. You know, a lot of leaders and managers listen to this podcast and they're thinking, okay, I've got new people that have come on. They've just onboarded on my team, but I don't really know them. But I see on their CV that they are very competent and knowledgeable and experienced. In yourself, how do you trust certain team members that maybe that are fresh, that are local, that have that knowledge on the ground, but you don't really have that connection, that chemistry with them yet, because there hasn't been enough time to allow that. What do you do to build those bridges of trust, to build that rapport with those new individuals?
Well, again, with the number of personnel and staff working under my responsibility, it was impossible for me to know each of them. Mm. Of course not. But I had a responsibility, at least with those that were coordinating the zones and the states. Those are the key drivers that was helping us to move our agenda. And this was, I had daily, not weekly, daily teleconferences with the state and zonal coordinators by zones, right?
Yes, yes.
Speaking with them, with my team in my headquarters in Abuja in Nigeria. The same I had organized it in when I was in Angola, in Luanda. So we had a regular, on a daily basis, rotating by zones, speaking with them, and possible visiting them on the ground. This was very critical. Yeah. And you see in locals. And one thing that I did, because we had several partners providing financial resources to WHO, I used to bring ambassadors. And I also take with me during my visits the heads of health session from the embassy. Go there and to see on the ground, this is what your money is helping us to move the agenda. This was, again, the best way to build trust and to see you guys are not hiding. You are showing us the good things and where the things didn't work. I used to most show them. This is not working. I had also, every time that I used to the states, I had a meeting with the governor. Even before I go to the province, I request the government permission for me to go there. Because I was a member of the UN. So it was necessary to get the green light. And I always used to sit with them and speak with them. Because sometimes the governors are those that are leading what is happening on health and education and everything. And they have a good knowledge, an integrated knowledge about what's going on in the state. But sometimes, this sometimes is the problem in several countries, not only in Nigeria or in Angola, whatever it is. Sometimes you are afraid to explain to your supervisor, I'm failing on this. I cannot do better. So you need somebody that can blow the whistle and say, sir, this is not working properly. But don't come on with the problems. As always, I used to say, if I show the problem, you need to give him or her what are the solutions to fix the problem. And bring your people to help and say, these are the hands that is going to help you and your local government to take actions. So again, we need to be part of the solution, not part of the problems. Everybody knows the problems. So indeed, what I used to say, when you lead, success is about your people. So this, when they see the things are moving, they feel also proud. And this is what, when you lead people, you need to walk beside them. That is very important. This is why when I used to go to the provinces or to the districts or to the states, I used to bring my people with me. So this is a way to feel I am part of the solution. I am part of this team. But again, come with solutions. Don't come to identify problems that everybody knows those problems. That is the most critical part.
And I think, again, you make so many salient points, but just to pick down some of them, you know, one of the things, as you said, is it's complete transparency. This is what we're doing well, and this is what's not going so well. And so that builds trust because people see a sense of vulnerability. And when someone, and that's true courage, that's true leadership. When, at least from my experience talking to leaders such as yourself of your caliber, is that every leader I've spoken to says, you know, we are vulnerable this way, and this is what we've done well, and this is where we could improve. And I think, as you said, you walk among the ranks. You're not sitting there in some sort of tower. You're there with your people. You're talking to them in one-to-ones or in monthly or quarterly meetings, touching base with them. And I think that is so important for leaders and managers to understand that resilience is when you are part of the team and not just consider yourself leading the team, even though technically, yes, on paper, you are leading the team and you are at the head of the hierarchy, but it's to be amongst the team, to be a part of the team. I would just like to rewind for a second, Rui. You said, you know, a lot of these people, some of your staff, maybe they've lost colleagues, maybe they were killed or lost in accidents. They haven't seen their family for maybe a year. They, in some of these places, there's not the health personnel or the support sometimes, such as the psychologist to kind of debrief. I'm curious, in certain places like Northern Nigeria, where you have UN staff that reported to you, how do you create a sense of stability, a sense of certainty, a sense of connectedness with those employees that are literally on the front line in a very complex situation?
You know, again, it's a matter of ensuring that you are present with them. Present not physically every time, but at least communicating to them through your state coordinators or those that are leading at local level. But one thing that we also introduce there is to avoid to leave people there for 1 year doing routine things. I have asked them to move our colleagues from one state to another state. Going, if you are in an environment where war is there, where you have conflicts, you have threats every single day, your head is going out quickly. You lose your capacity to think. So it's important, at least after in complex situations, move your staff for a safer place. Keep them outside. And then when the things are more stabilized, you can continue to rotate people. And those that were also very good examples that I also introduced is when you had also polio and other outbreaks, the case of EPD in other African countries in the African region. I have requested my WHO country directors to take some of our staff to go there and to help explaining to them what we did in Nigeria. So when they came back, they said, I feel proud that you sent me to share with them our experience. And I learned a lot also from them. So this is what the team building, and not think about your own boundaries. Think outside. You know, your experience should not be limited on the physical, geographical space where you work. Think outside. I was, during Ebola, during polio, I had monthly, if not needed, on a weekly interactions with my WHO country directors from the neighboring countries, explaining to them what we are doing, because we had cross-border activities because of population movement. So this was a way. But one important issue and lessons learned is if you want to succeed, you need determination. But you need, most important, you need to be self-confident on what you are doing. Don't be afraid, as I said, to take actions. You need to be resilient because you have too many challenges. But the most important, when you work with the team, engage them, not in the implementations, but thinking about the strategies. And the example is the accountability framework. We put all of them, before we started defining the key performance indicators, we engage them to agree on those performance indicators. And everybody agreed, this is the way for us, and we move. So this is what I also learned during all of these years of my experience in public health.
Well, thank you for articulating that, because I think that's very important where, you know, when staff or employees are feeling stressed, and in this case, I mean, extreme stress, whether it's disease or warfare or combat or invasion, what have you, is that it's to rotate people outside, take them out of their tour duty, put them somewhere so they can recoup and regenerate, and then they can go back. And that sort of rotation sounds very healthy from a psychological perspective to help people to feel grounded again and they feel safe. In the concluding part of our conversation, Rui talks about the importance of confidence. And I specifically asked Rui, well, how does someone, when they're filled with self-doubt, move to self-confidence? His answer? Well, it was quite pragmatic, quite practical, and it's about embracing experience, embracing the struggle, learning and adapting from an ongoing situation. And part of that movement in that direction, well, we can call that humble leadership. And what that simply means is putting our ego on pause, setting it aside, and understanding, communicating to people that we have vulnerabilities, that to admit that we don't know everything, and that often we should tap into those that report to us. People bring a wealth of information and knowledge and experience and wisdom that we can draw from to help us to make more decisive decisions, where they can be part of the process, the discussion, where they feel a sense of ownership. And through discussing with our colleagues, with our team members, well, that is a solid way from shifting us from self-doubt, self-confidence. Because what are we talking about? When we're talking about priorities, we're talking about actions and efforts and where we can invest our time and our energies. Well, I'll let Rui speak more to this. So I hope you enjoy this concluding part of our conversation. You mentioned something, it's about determination and being decisive, and that is based in the root of self-confidence, and it's to act on things. If I may tap into a little bit of your psychology here, Rui, you know, all of us feel self-doubt sometimes, But with some of those people that I'm talking, that are listening to our conversation right now, you know, they may be filled with self-doubt and they hear from someone with your caliber and experience, find the self-confidence and act. What do you do to shift from self-doubt to self-confidence? I mean, how do you make that shift so you can have, you can be decisive and that you can be determined?
Well, mainly speaking with other colleagues. We don't know everything. Nobody teaches you at the faculty in the primary school or secondary school how to do it. You need to learn by doing. But learning by doing, you need to listen to other people. Even if it's opinions that are not like your opinion, but listen to them. And then you, when you decide, explain why you did it differently. And if you agree on what they have suggested, show them how you are implementing. As in a marathon, a long way to go. But you need to see along of the road, if things are going well, adjust. And adjust involving your team. And say, this is going well, let's continue. Like a team that is winning, so you don't change the team. But when sometimes the team gets tired also, and then you need to identify new ways to continue to move and refuel our people to continue to take action. So that is important. But one important aspect that I forgot to mention, leadership is not given. You must earn it. And this is why I'm saying it. Because when we had Ebola, the head of state, at that time it was the president, Goodluck Jonathan, he requested the Minister of Health for WHO to lead all international partners in Nigeria to address the Ebola. So I had left the country 3 days ago, three days before the epidemic came. So I had to return from Europe to Nigeria 3 days after. And I went straight from there to speak with the minister who was waiting for me and say, Mr. President requests WHO to lead the team. Again, it's not because of beautiful eyes that you have. You need to earn leadership. And earning leadership means you need to show capacity. And our capacity has been shown with interruption of the polio transmission. So today, Nigeria is a polio-free country. So, and I was proud, to be frank, that I was part of the solution of the problems. It was a long road. But again, if you don't start today, you never have the opportunity to end the job. So as part of the legacy, after all of these years, I'm glad to see that the governments of Angola, the government of Nigeria, where I worked, they are using our experience addressing polio, addressing EVD, to strengthen the entire health systems, to strengthen the health capacity, to invest more in terms of training people and making them accountable. Because we have been training hundreds of thousands of people. But then, where are they? We lose them along the road. We need to continue to motivate them. If you train and you leave them without any accountability, I invest a lot of you. So what are you doing? So you need to have that capacity to continue to bring people together and to move. And this is why, you know, the self-confidence is very important. But you need also to be clear, what does it mean in the long-term process?
What really resonates with me is the type of leadership you speak of and that you live and breathe is I classify it as humble leadership. As you said, you're sometimes filled with self-doubt, but then you reach out to your colleagues to speak about your self-doubt, to speak about how to move forward. And through that conversation, you get to articulate your thoughts and emotions about the issue. You get to, as you said so succinctly, you need to listen to what they have to say, take it on board. Maybe not everything floats, some ideas sink, but it's through that increasing the context of the conversation and talking to like-minded colleagues, or they don't have to be like-minded colleagues, but just colleagues themselves, you get to kick around ideas. And that in itself helps you to build confidence. And as you said, moving along the highway, sometimes you need to slow things down in order to speed things up. And slowing things down is admitting that you don't know everything, that you reach out to your colleagues for help, support, and for counsel in which you can speak about ideas and to articulate those ideas. And then that in itself, when you hear the conversation of what you actually speak out loud, emotions or your thoughts or your beliefs around something, that leads you from self-doubt to self-confidence. Is that what I understand you've articulated to me?
Definitely, yes.
And I think there's so much there that you've spoken to that, you know, people will be rewinding and listening and picking apart all those particular types of skills. Because if I shifted to you as a leader yourself, what would you say one of the toughest lessons that you've learned in your career?
Well, it's difficult. But the key one is to put in your mind what are your capacities, how you define priorities in a complex situation, how you are going to engage with others, involving them. And one of the good things that it was very interesting, particularly in Nigeria, I had the quarterly meetings with the head of state, with the president of the country. And I was speaking there on behalf of the different partners. For me, at the beginning, it was a challenge. But you need to be self-confident. You are representing all partners, and to speak and explain to the head of state in front of the ministers, in front of parliamentarians, in front of senators that used to be there in those meetings, and explain to them the reality. Tell them the truth. You are going there not to be always politically correct. You need to be able, as an international organization, as UN leading agency on health, to blow the whistle. They say, this is what's going on. Then it's not my country. It's the responsibility of the governments to take actions, to say, this is a good advice. And I do remember one time when I was in a meeting.
Yes.
And we were speaking about sustainable development goals. And when I mentioned something about the data, the quality of the data, what happened is the head of the SDGs mentioned, interrupt me and say, I'm sorry, but this is not correct. The president asked, Madam, please listen what the WHO representative is saying. Sit with him. Look what are the issues and try to move. He's not here to blame you. He's here to help us to improve the quality of data. This is another good example that you need to be to understand that you are there to support the countries. But this, again, comes to the trust. You need to have a good interactions, not only with the Minister of Health. When you are WHO country representative, I had meetings with Minister of Finance. I had meetings with Minister of Education. Today, health is you cannot do anything alone by health. We need to involve the different stakeholders to be part of the issue. So the other challenge for me, it was addressing big teams. You know, you come from the school, you go there, nobody teach you how to address. Sometimes it's much more easier to learn about technical issues rather than to work with different teams, with different backgrounds, to understand their own behaviors. Why are these guys behaving like this? And try to understand and to try to help him or her to overcome their own challenges. So this is what I can say, Jason.
Well, I think that was quite succinct and quite to the point. I'm just respectful of your time, Rui. I know you need to go in a few minutes. As a last question, you know, there's young leaders, male and female, coming through up through different organizations, and they're learning to build their confidence, and they do not have the depth of experience and knowledge as such as some of their senior colleagues. What advice would you give to young leaders coming up through organizations as to, yeah, just generally, what advice would you give them?
First, when you go to a country, don't think that you are the unique brain that arrived in that country. Try first to learn. Sometimes you see young people coming to a country, looking that they know better than you that have been working there for 20, 30 years, and come already with solutions when you don't know the background. You know, don't know the environment. So first come, listen to the people, try to understand the realities, the context, and then provide your suggestions in an humble way. Not everybody is stupid in the world. You have brains. You have people that are working there. One thing that I used to do also is when I go to the States is to meet the traditional and religious leaders. These are those that know the reality much better than anybody, sometimes better than the governors. So go speak with them. When you organize the polio campaigns, when you organize the communication strategies vis-a-vis the containing Ebola, we engage them, the traditional leaders, the religious leaders. This, if you are a newcomer to the country, go speak with the people. Don't start making noise for nothing. So try to understand the realities. This is first. Second one, try to be part of the team. Try to engage them since the beginning. Try to understand what is the background. Identify what are the priorities. And then yourself, based on your own capacity, be humble yourself. Try to see, I can do this. I don't have expertise on this. Don't try to jump in areas that you are not confident, technical or whatever it is. If you are not, it's a good timing for you to learn. Learn with others by doing.
Thank you, Rui. I really appreciate all you've shared with us today, your experiences and your stories. They add a lot to this picture of resilience. And I hope we have a chance to speak later in 2023.
Anytime, Jason.
Thanks very much, Rui, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All the best and good luck for you.
Well, folks, that was Dr. Rui Gama Vaz, a former leader and coordinator who worked with the WHO, the World Health Organization, where he served in many different capacities. I wanted to send a big thank you and appreciation to you, Rui, for joining me again today. I think your knowledge, your experience, your wisdom, your practicalities, and the lessons that you've learned in some of those complex situations facing multiple challenges will be a bounty for any of my listeners. And so I'm glad we've had this conversation because now it's part of the archive. It's part of the collection that we can all draw from. Well, folks, that brings us to a tale of another episode, a very fascinating episode. As usual, if I may give you a call to action, if you could please rate, subscribe, recommend this podcast, this episode to two friends or two colleagues or maybe two family members, anyone you think would find this of interest or could benefit from the knowledge shared today. Well, folks, thanks again. I appreciate you showing up as you do every week. Until next time, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon. Thank you.